It's the pre-election 2015 edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, kneecap political hijacking, strategic voting, talking points to motivate the vote, and why this election matters. Let's begin episode 213.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's Radio Free Thinker is a special edition. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know there's an election. And this coming Monday will be, in my humble opinion, the most important election in Canada's modern history. And why would I make such a dire statement? Well, as regular listeners to the show have heard on more than one occasion, the Harper government is the most dangerous and destructive one we've seen to our nation. Why do I say this? Well, it's not just that I detest this regime's ideology and views. There have been a number of previous governments that I have shared no love for. Nor has the exercise of power been, in general, worse than previous. The late Pierre Elliott Trudeau has been credited with creating the PMO's office as the locus of executive power. That is, the Prime Minister's office is now a new branch of government that has, in the current iteration, supplanted all other branches with the possible exception of the Supreme Court, sort of a super version of the United States presidency. No, the tools have been around for a while, but it is Harper who is taking these to new extremes and has used these tools of the government to destroy Canada, at least as we knew it. Now, some of you, new to the show, may be asking, what do I mean? Well, in the past, a number of governments have enacted legislation that have been disagreeable to me, or the country, or run contrary to the majority of the citizens' best interest. But such legislation could be undone by subsequent governments. Even the dreadful Free Trade and NAFTA had a 6-month exit clause. No, this government has signed deals that require a 35-year commitment. They have destroyed institutions like the Canadian Wheat Board that cannot realistically ever be reconstituted. They have blinded our nation by eliminating the long-form census. They have cut the CBC and Canada Post to the point where they are, for lack of a better word, terminal. That irrespective of the next non-con government, these institutions are as good as dead. And in spite of the damage already done, in spite of an unprecedented popular uprising against Harper and his regime, there's a very real chance that he may be re-elected. If that happens, and I'm aware of what I'm going to say sounds really extreme, but I truly believe to be justified in making the statement, it will be the end of the nation of Canada as we know it. The damage of another term will force many of us to want to emigrate, having been left with no other option than to leave this mutated, monstrous country that Harper will have created. You may be asking, if there's an unprecedented popular uprising against Harper, how could he possibly be re-elected? So first, let me explain what I mean by uprising. As an example, the ABC campaign, also known as the Anyone But Conservative, started by our war veterans, a call that has been taken up by other diverse groups such as unions, environmentalists, civil servants, and others. The sole point of this group is to ensure Harper is not re-elected. There are efforts by groups like Lead On and StrategicVote.ca who have been canvassing the streets in an attempt to coordinate strategic voting with the aim of denying the cons a re-election victory. The groundswelling of anger at this government is unprecedented. But the sad fact is, we don't live in a true democracy. With less than 40% of the vote, Harper has achieved a 54% majority in Parliament. And note that the difference between a minority government status in 2008, where he had only 46% of the seat, he gained less than 2% of the popular vote, but that translated into a 10% increase in seats, and thus his majority in Parliament. That even with the fact that over 60% of Canadians rejected Harper and his dystopian vision for Canada. So let me return to the question. With such a popular uprising, how could Harper have any chance of winning? As already implied, he doesn't need to be concerned about the majority of Canadians, but a small percentage, the 1% strategy I discussed in a previous episode of Radio Free Thinker. And where might those 1% come from? Enter stage right, the niqab. This is the headdress worn by small-c conservative Muslims that completely covers the face, leaving only the eyes visible. The root of the issue started when a woman in Ontario wanted to take a public citizenship oath while wearing the niqab. This was in contravention of a 2011 policy change, which was enacted by the Cons that stated anyone taking the oath of loyalty had to be honest, it's hard to talk about that change because I haven't been actually able to find the text of it. That said, on Immigration Canada's website, it provided the excuse to ban the veil/niqab as follows, and I shall quote here. The government believes that it obstructed judges from recognizing people taking the citizenship oath, and the ban was an attempt to make the new citizens follow Canadian norms. It seems the premise, at least the first part, is to ensure the person taking the oath is the person who is being granted citizenship. Now, the fact that the identity of the prospective citizen is confirmed, in private, by the officiating judge. So even if no one else makes facial identification, the judge does. So it's not like a faker could slip through. And even if the person taking the oath was not the person whose ID will appear on the citizenship papers, under what kind of scenario would anyone go to all the effort to have a stand-in, an understudy of sorts, take the oath? Perhaps they envisioned some cartoonish plot where Saif al-Adel will be hiding behind the niqab, and once the oath is taken, will rip off the disguise and go, "Ha-ha! I'm now a citizen and we'll get free healthcare. No backsies. I took the oath. You have to let me in." Perhaps more risky, if less plausible, is the chance that maybe some terrorist is trying to sneak in and boom, blow up everything. But again, someone has to make facial recognition, confirmation that the person is who they claim to be, before the public ceremony. So this logic gets farcical. Now, it's important to people involved, and at last report, Zunera Ashak, who instigated the court challenge, has won and has now become a Canadian citizen. Another civil rights defeat for Harper. And far from his only one. Small potatoes, really. That was until the first debate in Quebec. It was when the issue was brought up by Gilles Duceppe in a Hail Mary to resurrect the corpse of the Bloc that the niqab took center stage. Now, Duceppe had been using this as a wedge issue all along, but suddenly the lights went off in Harper's head. A way to crack the lock the NDP had in Quebec, and a great way to shift attention away from important issues to this racist phantasm. Okay, that last bit may be a little strong. Well, relatively accurate. Don't get me wrong, there are parts of the world where women are forced, with violence, to wear the garb they wish not to. But in Canada, this is no more of an issue than forcing waitresses to wear skimpy uniform. For those truly oppressed or offended, there are sufficient social mechanisms to ensure women's freedoms. Often the niqab and female genital mutilation are conflated, to the point where there is now a hotline to report acts of mutilation. Again, an issue the world must address and women need protection from, but also something that doesn't occur here. There's not one incidence of it happening here in Canada that I could find. So why is it such an issue? During the panel debate on At Issue on the CBC, Andrew Coyne said it was frivolous and a waste of time when compared to the more sentient issues of healthcare, the economy, and the environment. Chantal Aubert quickly and passionately shot back. How dare he tell Quebec what was important? The fact that it was such a major issue in Quebec defines the fact that it is important, and in Quebec, perhaps the most important election issue of all. To be fair, in the Quebec context, this is not coming from nowhere. In the last provincial election, the secular charter, promoted by the Bloc Québécois, was ostensibly a charter to increase the separation of church and state. There were three important clauses. One, establish a duty of neutrality and reserve for all state personnel. Two, limit the wearing of conspicuous religious symbols for said personnel. And three, make it mandatory to have one's face uncovered when providing or receiving a state service. Now, in practice, this would mean that Muslims who wear the niqab and hijab would be excluded from government employee. It would also include things like the turban and the kapan, which actually target the Sikh. In fact, the only people beyond those people who may be excluded are perhaps ultra-Orthodox Jews, perhaps some extremely fundamental evangelicals, and I guess the Pope. Again, the justification of this is to ensure that the state is in no way advocating or promoting any religion. a sentiment I wholeheartedly support. But of course, the test of an idea is in its execution. The secular nature of the proposal was belied by the fact exemptions were being made for large crosses that appear at government buildings, such as the National Assembly, as well as the observance of Christmas, for, of course, historical cultural reasons. They are not religious icons, but symbols of Quebec's cultural history, or so say the apologists. Then, of course, prayer in meetings was also deemed allowable if performed by an elected politician, because if we have religious leadership, it should come from the political leadership, or something. No, the aim of the Charter was not to protect Quebecers from religion, but from foreign dilution of the Quebec culture. This is where I point out there is a glaring irony that the province that has demanded minority rights, that have championed the rights of minorities against the sullied masses of English Canada, has done an about-face and seems to view minorities as some form of wrinkle that needs to be flattened or smoothed over, demanding conformity. And to be fair, Quebec was never in favor of minority rights. They were in favor of francophone rights. In fact, the fetishization of Quebec culture, such as Quebec's language law, is so strong now that everyone must conform to a single mode. The old stock Canadian that Harper was appealing to in the Globe and Mail debate was not so much a dog whistle, as they say, to the Western elderly socially conservative base, although it was, but more ears perked up in Quebec, where this apparently is a very common term to delineate French or old stock Canadians from the upstart English. Although the origins of the term may have faded with time, in Quebec there is no doubt about what Harper was saying. Although it would be a week later that the Najab maelstrom would arise, Gilles Duceppe was already harping on the issue from day one and set the stage for Harper's diversion. I am sure Harper has seen this issue as a godsend. Instead of talking about the return of the recession, Syrian refugees, Duffy, and other issues the cons have been wishing people would ignore, well, one little wand called the Niqab makes rational substance debate flee, and in its stead we have a devices conversation on racism and assimilation. To double down on the issue, one that Harper has used to critically undermine the NDP, he was asked during an interview on CBC's Power and Politics, what were the limits, or perhaps, when does the slippery slope end? The line by the interview goes like this. But, what is the limit then? What a government then tells someone to do. If you're willing to tell this woman that she can't live her life like this, that she can't wear this at the ceremony, then where do you put the limits? A public service worker, for instance, in the civil service? Someone who has a public position? Should they be allowed to? You could see a bit of an, oh, I have a great idea, gleam in Harper's eye. He then responded by saying, quote, that's a matter we're going to examine. Quebec, as you know, has legislation on this, and we're looking at that legislation. You could almost see the gears churning in his head. Then, of course, the next day, it becomes a major plank of the Conservative Party. It is sad that when dealing with minority rights, the justification used to impose a dress code on immigrants, for now, of course, if you're old stock Canadian and wish to don a niqab, you will also become an un-Canadian. It is a tired, old, and ironic appeal to popularism. And again, to quote Harper, Canadians have a right to establish the basic values around the ceremony that are reflected of our basic values of a society. The vast, vast majority of Canadians understand our position on this and are behind it. The other parties that have decided to make this an issue because they are frankly offside of public opinion. And that's their choice. You know, as someone who's an atheist, and at one time I wouldn't have been allowed to perform many, many things like be on a jury or do the citizenship because I wouldn't swear to God. I mean, he does understand what minority rights are. I mean, the whole point of rights is to protect individuals and minorities from the tyranny of the majority. Harper seems to have a more totalitarian view on the issue. So what the hell are we doing? Well, the media at least. I am unsure, and forgive my optimism, that this is going to be a real issue amongst the voting population. But that said, I am truly disappointed that so much virtual ink has been wasted on such a non-issue. Again, relative to the other more pressing issues. I mean, think about it. Harper is so worried about women's rights and how we should legislate what they wear, and yet could give a feck about Aboriginal women who are victims of violence and abuse, with hundreds dead. His hypocrisy knows no bounds. Some listeners have asked why I, as the host of Radio Freethinker, has spent so much time, so many hours on this topic. Well, the truth is, I fear for our democracy. Some people may not be aware, but Hitler was democratically elected to office. Now, before I get Godwinned, I don't think Harper is Hitler, even in the slightest degree. Hitler was a sociopathic, genocidal demagogue bent on world domination. Harper is not genocidal. He has no quest for world domination, and his personality doesn't really lend itself to demagoguery. Although I think the jury's still out on the whole sociopathic part, Harper is no Hitler. But it is important to note how easy it is to lose one's democracy. I think Harper has discovered a way to use electoralism to destroy our democracy, to perhaps establish a plutocracy, whether he means so or not. Electoralism is a halfway transition from democratic rule to authoritarian rule, where a single party becomes dominant and uses that dominance to essentially game the system to ensure ongoing electoral supremacy, with such things as rewriting electoral laws to give the dominant party an obvious advantage, by using the organs of government to silence, think scientists and bureaucrats, to intimidate, think environmentalists and nonprofit groups, and by conflating party and nation so people see little distinction, think loyalty oaths and rebranding the government of Canada to the Harper government. Let us not forget his most infamous and scary line, at least in hindsight, quoted by his biographer, where he laid out his plans for autocracy, where he stated that, and let me quote the devil himself, "The longer I am prime minister, the longer I will be prime minister." We now see what he meant. The longer I can control the apparatus of the state, the easier it will be to use that apparatus to ensure my continual control of the state. This is why this election is such a test case. Believe me when I say, I hope I'm overreacting. But I'm not alone. There has never been this kind of anti-incumbent popular uprising in the history of this country. Even when the Liberals were swamped by scandal, people were dissatisfied, disappointed, disaffected, but we didn't have any citizen organizing a get rid of them. No, there's no equivalent to the ABC, an ABL, if you will, anyone but liberal movement. No, this is a unique moment in time. There have always been pressures to vote strategically, a tactic I normally am against, but these are not normal times. And this has actually escalated to where third and fourth tier candidates who don't agree to bow out of a riding are actually being targeted with hate mail and that because people are so afraid that their interference may help the Conservatives win re-election. Okay, I'm gonna take a bit of a deep breath here. Okay, loyal listeners to Radio Freethinker are aware we are in the last week of the election. Now is the time not only to rally the troops, but bring out the vote. It is in this capacity that I hope we can all accept responsibility. It is not enough in a democracy to voice our opinions, but to act on them. I challenge every one of my listeners to vote, to get their friends to vote, your neighbors, your co-workers, out to vote. Don't rely on the party machinery to do that for you. Take a stand, it's our democracy, or we'll lose it. I've been quite encouraged to hear that voter turnout at the advance polling is booming. It does seem like people are taking their duty as citizenship to exercise their right to vote seriously, as they should. Our nation's at stake. Remember, when you vote, you need one piece of ID with your photo and your address on it. Think driver's license or BCID. If you don't have a photo ID with your address on it, then you need two pieces of ID. One that proves who you are, and another that proves where you live. Think health card, credit card statement, utility bill, student card. But remember, you need two of them, and at least one of them must have your address on it, and both of them must have your name on it. And thankfully, if you're a virtual bill payer, such as myself, you can present e-statements or e-invoices, either as a printout or on a mobile device. And be creative if you're a student. People have been using prescription bottles that have their name and local address on them. Don't let the bastards take away your voice. More info for students. Those who have nothing with their local address on it, well, you can still vote. Bring your two pieces of ID that have your name on them and a friend or family member who's registered in the same polling station that you should be voting at. They can then take an oath that you live where you say you live, and your vote will count. Now that person can only vouch for one other. So if you live in a dorm or the like, go out and find a vouching buddy. Plan the voting day. Maybe take them out for a post-vote coffee and watch the election results roll in. This is important. Don't leave this to the last minute. It's your future, and it's at risk. Okay, so now I task you with another quest. Because there really are some people who do think the NCAB is the most important issue because, well, let's face it, most people tend to follow their favorite hockey team more than politics, where the winner of the World Series is more important to their lives than who governs the country, which is a sad state of affair. But we need to reach those people and let them know what's at stake, what's important, and why. So we're going to take a little bit of a break, and when we come back, I'm going to give you a list of talking points to disseminate amongst your peers in this all-important last week of the campaign. So hear you on the other side.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at savecanadapost.ca.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Okay, I put forward some reasons to turf the anti-democratic, destructive Harper Conservative governments in a number of episodes. I suggest you check them out. Here's a quick list. Episode 284, Sins of the Harper. 290, 50 Shades of Fear. 291A, The Politics of Fear. Sorry, that one's only available on our website, but go in and take a listen. 293, The Election Budget Edition. 296, The Wheat Board Ripoff Edition. And 305, The Dropping of the Writ Edition. That said, for those who lack the inclination or time to listen to those shows, let me list my reasons for dumping Harper and his cons. Let's start off with the cons claim and people's erroneous acceptance as a conservative strength that they're good on the economy. They're good money managers. Well, let's chew on these nuggets. Overpayment of Arctic patrol ships. The government is now committed to approximately $33 billion in the procurement of naval ships. Among those are six Arctic patrol ships. According to the Parliamentary Budget Office, each ship is expected to cost Canadians $700 million. And yet the Norwegians, upon whose design these ships are based, they built them at a cost of $100 million each. And that's just not the Norse. The Danish and the Irish likewise built these ships at a fraction of the price Harper is paying. Overpaying for fighter jets, the F-35, which we were told would cost about $141 million, but again, as the Parliamentary Budget Officer revealed, would have a true cost of $41 billion for the 65 planes on order. In fact, as the true cost of the Albatross became known, more and more nations were canceling their orders for the F-35. It was also made evident that the way the jets were selected was not through open competition for bids, but an edict from on high. Likely some under-the-table handshake between Canada and U.S. military. Nonetheless, we could have procured the more popular Super Hornets at half the cost. Billions of subsidies for big oil. The Harper government has provided over $35 billion in subsidies for the oil and gas industry. Most of this is in tax credits and other non-payment agreements, but imagine what the government could have done with 35 extra billion dollars. then there are bad treaties, like with China and the TPP. Harper signed a deal with China that we are locked into for 35 years, which provides Chinese companies the ability to challenge Canadian law. Not in a courtroom, but via arbitration. Arbitration is always pro-corporate. He has doubled down on the corporate takeover of Canada by agreeing to the TPP. Advertising on phantom and terminated programs. Did you know that they spent $2.5 million on a job grants program promotion that never actually existed? The Harper Conservative government spent another $14-plus million on Canada's Economic Action Plan, 2 years after the program had ended. Well, I guess it's not his money. It is promoting the party at taxpayers' expense, a fiscally responsible thing to do. Yes, I guess, according to Harper. Then there's the hypocrisy of reducing the debt. If the debt was so important, if balancing the books was such a concern, why does Harper take every opportunity to cut taxes? He may be laboring under the false premise that lowering taxes increases tax intake. That you get a smaller percentage, but because it stimulates the economy, the lower percentage has a greater gross value than you would get if you had a higher rate. This is what George Bush the Senior called voodoo economics and has been thoroughly disproven. And then, of course, you have the election budget of 2015, which, to give his devil his due, was masterfully done to show how you can use sleight of hand to win an election. For example, selling our GM stocks early, thus costing us millions, but helping to create a balanced budget. And by using EI surpluses, again, to help us appear to have a balanced budget. And then there's those stealth cuts, and this is obscene, where the government promises to spend X amount of dollars on some issue. Praise be to Harper. Then, once the spotlights are off and no one is looking, the money's not spent, or a fraction of it, and the rest is returned to the government coffers. Spending promises actually turn out to be spending cuts. And then there's our dependency on the oil industry, the lack of diversification of our economy. It was telling that when the price of oil dropped precipitously this year, that the government had to delay the budget because, well, they had no plan B. So dependent were they on oil income that when the bottom dropped out, they were left scrambling. Which leads to the ultimate failure of the cons as managerial masterminds. Every economist knows, and most rational people understand, that in a capitalist free-ish market, there are cycles. Prices on commodities, especially raw materials such as oil, well, price goes up, price goes down. A prudent manager will take the profits of good times and invest them in diversification, so that when one part of the economy is experiencing recession, other parts can take up the slack, and thus avoiding something like the double dip recession we're going through now. I found it telling in a line that Mulcair used when he stated that Harper will be the first prime minister in Canadian history who, when asked about the recession, will need to be clarified as to which one they're referring to. And now, related to the myth of conservative economic prowess is the idea that they're good stewards of the nation. First, partly in a quest to balance budgets, and in part living up to Norquist's pledge of shrinking government down to the size where it can be drowned in the bathtub, Harper has overseen a radical cut in government departments. This includes things like defunding food safety. I mean, really, what's a little botulism between citizens? And then there's the war on sex workers, where most civilizations are beginning to understand that sex work is work, and that to criminalize them or their clients' activity just creates a dangerous situation for the people Harper claims he is trying to protect. This disdain for people who are not of his class is echoed in his refusal to acknowledge this is a crisis for Indigenous women, that First Nations are still in crisis, that his black and white libertarian views that there are no social injustices, only individual crimes. That kind of thinking puts people's lives in danger. Lives are being lost. And as part of his tough-on-crime policy, well, we all believe people should be held accountable and pay for their wrongdoings. But the Conservative Party seems to want vengeance. The vehemence of Harper, who not only wants to punish criminals, but see that they're made to suffer. To ensure that once you commit a crime, you will wish for the return of capital punishment, as it will be the only thing that will provide release. And the hypocrisy of his love of victims. When the Harper government shifted the financial burden of his victim support programs from the dependable federal purse to an unreliable, inadequate pockets of the convicted, not only did he victimize the convicted, but he re-victimized the afflicted by ensuring that those support programs are underfunded and thus unreliable. On the note of hypocrisy, Harper is quick to sing the praises of the military, yet when it comes to veteran affairs, not only does his government turn a deaf ear, the Veterans Affairs Department not only failed to spend the money provided to it and actually returned $1.13 billion. Why? Harper balanced the budget with backdoor cuts. It is telling that veterans, a traditionally strong conservative support base, should be the ones that initiated the ABC campaign, the Anyone But Conservative movement. And if you thought the cons were worried about whether or not you have a job, well, we were all enlightened when the scandal of the Temporary Foreign Workers Program came to light, where Harper initiated his own form of the ABC, Anyone But Canadian Initiative. Then, of course, you have the way this government has destroyed Canada's image on the international stage. At one time, having a Canadian flag on your backpack was a badge of honor. Now it's a source of embarrassment. In part, this has come about because of our unconditional support of Israel, something that is perhaps a psychological scar from Harper's upbringing. But the extremism this government has expressed to not only support Israel in spite of war crimes, but to also condemn any criticism of Israel, equating it to anti-Semitism, that support for Palestine is a support for terrorism, and that in itself is anti-Semitic. This was most embarrassingly evident during the famous question period debacle. Let's listen into that.
Oral questions, questions orales. The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister has failed to answer clear questions about his ill-defined military deployment in Iraq. Yesterday, Conservatives refused once again to answer in this House, but the member for Selkirk Interlake stated on CPAC that the mission will end on October 4th. Will the Conservative government confirm that the 30-day Canadian commitment in Iraq will indeed end on October 4th?
The Honourable Parliamentary Secretary and the Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, there's a great deal of confusion with respect to the NDP position on Israel. I wonder if the Leader of the Opposition could confirm for me whether Alex Anderson, who identifies himself as a fundraiser at the New Democratic Party, if he speaks for the NDP when he says, F the IDF and all who supports them, I'm sick and tired of the media BS trying to sell lies and hide a effing genocide. Does Alex Anderson speak for the NDP when he says these shameful things?
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Well, I can understand the confusion. We are in the Middle East and we are under the eyes, but we're talking about Iraq. It took over a week for the Prime Minister to answer a simple question about the number of troops involved in the Iraqi deployment. It now appears that Canadian soldiers may require visas approved by the Iraqi government. Since this military deployment is still ongoing, and since it's set to conclude in 12 days, precisely how many Canadian soldiers are on the ground in Iraq today?
Leader of the Opposition not understand that our friends in Israel are on the front lines combating terrorism, Mr. Speaker. So when people who work for the NDP, like Alex Anderson, who identifies himself as a fundraiser at Canada's NDP, calls that what the Israeli Defense Forces are doing a effing genocide and calls the media BS for not supporting the fact that they call it an effing genocide, what does he not understand? Israel is on the front lines. Canada will continue to support our friends in Israel. We'll stand up for peace and security around the world. And unlike them, we're not confused by our position.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, there are rules in the book about question period. You are our arbiter. We ask you to enforce the rules on relevance and on question period. When asked at Foreign Affairs Committee just a couple of weeks ago, the minister said that a status of forces agreement with Iraq outlining operating rules for Canadian forces had not yet been completed. Has that agreement now been completed? And if so, when can Canadians see it?
The Honourable Parliamentary Secretary of the Prime Minister.
Again, Mr. Speaker, clearly the leader of the NDP does not identify or understand the fact that our friends in Israel are on the front lines combating terrorism in the region, Mr. Speaker. That's why on this side of the House, we support our friends in Israel, Mr. Speaker. Unlike the NDP, whose position is all over the place, Canada will stand up for Israel, will stand up for freedom around the world, Mr. Speaker. The NDP calls the NDP an effing IDF, and all those who support it, Mr. Speaker, they claim that the media are ignoring it, call it BS. We'll stand up for Israel. We'll stand up for our...
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that does not speak very favourably about your neutrality in this House.
Another prime example of the government not answering questions, distracting people. I mean, what the hell does Israel have to do with answering those questions? And honestly, with the embarrassingly partisan inactivity of the Speaker of the House, he's supposed to be Speaker of the whole House and not just guardian of the cons. Well, again, democracy chipped away one small piece at a time. How can the government be held accountable when it doesn't even acknowledge Parliament exists? It's disgusting. It's a shame that more people are not getting mad and upset, but we have an election, maybe things will change. But it's more than Harper's pet project. There's also the about face we have taken on climate change. Now true, Harper's gone from a climate denialist to a climate nihilist. His government has made it its raison d'etre to hinder, hamper, and halt any attempts to address climate change on the global and obviously on the national stage. It has gotten so bad that at any international conference, Canada is either not invited or is ignored. A recent spending scandal regarding our Minister of Environment's attendance at a climate change conference in Peru had an interesting side note, that most of the attendees had left when it was Canada's turn to address the conference. Why? Because our reputation had been so tarnished and our opinions so disregarded. Then there's our reputation as world peacekeepers. We kind of invented the concept of peacekeepers, and yet, since gaining a majority, Harper is yet to see a global conflict that he does not want to participate in. If we are not stridently, if imprudently, strongly supporting one side against the other, then we're actually engaged in military operations. Again, why the hell are we wasting our efforts and money in bombing Syria? That money, those efforts, that political capital could be put to such more effective use. But that would not fulfill Harper's wish to be a big man on the globe. Maybe world domination is something Harper dreams about. And then there are the institutions, those elements that define what it means to be Canadian, that he has or is in the process of destroying. Let's start off with the Canadian Wheat Board. He destroyed, disbanded the Canadian Wheat Board, a collective monopoly for selling Canadian wheat and barley crops. This in spite of the fact that the vast majority of Canadian farmers wanted to keep the board and felt its collective power gave farmers a better price and security than without the board. Something, though, that the elimination of would be a boon for corporations that happen to support the Conservative Party. And to add insult to injury, he gave the Wheat Board's holdings away to foreigners. Holdings belonging to the member farmers of the Wheat Board, according to a 2011 financial statement, the last time public records were published. Why? Because when Harper converted the CWB to a private, soon-to-be-sold company, he also stopped the publication of its financial status. Making the financial statements public was something that had been done since the inception of the board. Yet another example of keeping us citizens in the dark. What we don't know can't hurt them. Anyway, according to the 2011 report, the board had revenues of over $7 billion, that had assets valued at $3.4 billion. And how much did Harper sell this farmer-owned resource for? $500 million. True. Sorry folks, no typo here. That means, on assets alone, it's a loss of almost $3 billion. This shows the complete incompetence of the cons when it comes to business, but speaks loudly to their commitment to ideology and their corporate overlords. another institution that has been on the cutting block. And to be fair, for more than one MP, it's the CBC. But Harper is the only one to have campaigned to promise not to cut funding to the extremely important public broadcaster. And then, within months of winning the election, do a complete turnaround by cutting the CBC's budget. There is a theme in some of these actions of Harper, and that is to restrict public access to information. And a national broadcaster is anathema to that quest. If Harper wins election, I bet the CBC will be privatized within a year. Another institution that's on the cutting block is Canada Post, a actually profitable corporation, in spite of legislation machinations that make it seem otherwise. Sure, people point out that snail mail is disappearing, but parcel post has been on a dramatic increase. It is only because the current government is forcing Canada Post to cover 75 years worth of pension plans each year that it seems to be making a loss. Whereas if it did anything that a normal corporation would do, it would be very much, very much a profitable company. So why destroy a profitable Crown Corporation? Well, I'm sure handsome donations from UPS and the like had nothing to do with it, nor the strong union movement with its tendency not to support the Conservatives. No, I'm sure that had very little to do with his position. And in the vein that any information is too much, there is the non-sequitur move of this government in the abolishment of the mandatory long-form census. Again, if someone like Stockwell Day claims that crime rates are up and we only have imperfect sources of information, they can dress up ideology as policy, and it becomes much more simpler to convince people when you have no accurate or independent source of data. Thus, the end of the long-form census and the cutbacks to StatsCan. Then there's the silencing of the scientists, and I would add bureaucracy, that any information generated by the civil servants, and that includes researchers under government contract, or grants, fall under Harper's personal domain. You can ask to see it, and maybe after a lot of effort, time, and money, you may be granted, or not. Nonetheless, Canadians are not only left in the dark, are not only denied information that they have a right to, not only denied access to information we, as citizens of this nation, own, but by keeping us in the dark, we lose, because one of the most fundamental foundations of a democracy is a well-informed electorate, something that Harper has made it his crusade to prevent. You can't complain about what you don't know, and what you don't know can't hurt them. And let's not forget, on that note, the defunding of real science, which has been redirected to corporate R&D, a sort of backdoor subsidy to corporations. Then there's the closing of scientific libraries, the wanton destruction of books and documents from research libraries, the closing of research labs across the country, and most notably the Environmental Lakes Project, an experiment over 45 years running. And here's a clip by ASAP Science about Harper's war on science. Let's listen in.
Science is everywhere. In nature's beauty, in a laugh between friends, the buildings we build, and the communities we form. It's constantly wondering, asking why things are the way they are. How can we make things better? What are we in the grand scheme of the universe? It spans from the depths of space to the device you're watching this video on right now. During the Enlightenment era, scientific revolution brought ideas around calculus, atomic theory, and gravity to our world. The Industrial Revolution saw significant technological and manufacturing developments, including the first cars, and in the digital age, scientists helped spur the formation of the internet as we know it, as a means to share research and ideas. Today, advances in medicine and agriculture have saved more lives than have been lost in all the wars in history. But despite these achievements, science and society are often at odds. Scientific discoveries like the Earth is round, that our planet revolves around the sun, or that diseases are spread through germs were all once ideas that were rejected by society. So much so that Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for suggesting the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, and even Galileo was sentenced to house arrest for supporting the theory. Today, we see the rejection of scientific evidence for vaccinations, leading to preventable diseases like measles coming back after being wiped out in the year 2000, or the rejection of scientific evidence for climate change, despite the vast consensus among scientists. As put by Carl Sagan, we live in a society exquisitely dependent on science and technology, in which hardly anyone knows anything about science and technology. And yet, when we look to history, we see that ignoring science has led to the crumbling of societies. Ancient Greece was a time of great learning around ideas of space, time, and light, and during the subsequent Roman Empire, these ideas were mostly embraced. However, the Romans were complacent with the learnings of the Greeks, and little innovation or exploration of new ideas around science and knowledge took place during this era. With shifting governments and values, emphasis on reason and science slipped away, and Rome eventually fell into the Dark Ages. Today, despite the voices of many supporting logic and reason, this war on science continues. In the UK, investment in publicly funded research has dropped to less than 0.5% of the GDP, the lowest it's been in two decades. This year, the US has cut at least $300 million from NASA's Earth Science budget, which just happens to include climate science. Not only does this mean that existing climate studies will be ignored, but useful data won't even be collected in the future, all to serve ideological agendas. But for what? The bank bailout in America cost more money than NASA's entire 50-year running budget, a budget that stirs imagination and visions for the future of our world and universe. In the military budget, 1 month of spending is equivalent to NASA's entire annual budget. Here in our home of Canada, the war on science is in full effect under Stephen Harper's conservative government. Our science libraries dedicated to health, environment, fisheries, and oceans are being shut down. Laws that were once in place to ensure the protection of endangered species have been gutted, with 80% of Canada's 71 freshwater fish species currently at risk of extinction. And not only has Prime Minister Stephen Harper eliminated the National Science Advisor role, but some 2,500 federal scientists have lost their jobs. In a recent survey, 90% of government scientists felt they could not speak freely about their research, and roughly 25% say they've been forced by the government to change their research for non-scientific reasons. We're told that the remaining funds are geared towards science that has a clear commercial output, which at first glance may seem fair, research that isn't a waste of money, so to speak. But when Einstein constructed the theory of relativity, did he know that it would lead to the development of GPS, nuclear energy, or the original television? These industries are worth billions, but focusing on commercial output is short-sighted, as science is often a slow, evolving, iterative process. Science is much more than a body of knowledge and applications. It's a way of thinking, a way to unravel the world's mysteries, see its beauty, where we can look at all the facts to make informed decisions instead of relying on preconceived notions and biases. Science doesn't choose a political party. It simply adheres to evidence. But just like good policy is supported by science, science is supported by funding and advocacy from our governments. So when you head to the polls to vote, wherever you may be, remember that a vote for science is a vote for knowledge and progress based in reality. Look at your party's policies on science and take a stand.
And lastly, remember the Harper Conservatives' criminal or near-criminal activities. The In-N-Out scandal, where they pushed the boundaries of party advertising to circumvent campaign spending limits. So dangerous was the scandal that when, as a minority leader, Parliament pushed for an investigation, Harper was to have nothing to do with it and call a snap election. Winning a majority in the 2011 election, the power to compel an investigation was gone, and so the possibility of getting to the bottom of the con's money laundering activities. Then we all know about the robocall scandal, which at least led to the conviction of a patsy of the con's, Michael Sona. And then there are the questionable appointments, both to the Senate and to the PMO's office. Questionable in that Harper's judgment in character seems to correlate with the RCMP's need to investigate people. Then we have the Senate spending scandal, of course, and the Duffy affair, which I think most people are missing the most criminal aspect of. It's not who cut the check, but what the purpose was for said check. Yes, to refund expense claims, but that was really only part of it. The more important part was to influence a government official, i.e. a Senate committee, to alter the report to make it less truthful, and basically to cover up the whole affair. And money, when used for a political cover-up, if that's not only bribery, it's got to be criminal fraud or something. And yet, he seems to get away with it. And then there's the contempt of Parliament. When it came to light that the government lied to Parliament with regards to cutting funding to an NGO, well, Harper called his snap election and won that, now with hindsight, disastrous election. Why? Because we thought that politics was boring, that each party was just like any other one. Sadly, we have learned that this government has a radical agenda, one that has had 4 years to implement, one that we must stop now, while we still can. This is Don saying, for sake's sake, get out and vote. We're going to close with some wise words from Rick Mercer on why you, the youth of Canada, need to get out and vote. Voting's easy. Not voting, that's the scary thing. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Voters right across this country head to the polls. Many, however, will not, including youth between the ages of 18 and 24, who have the lowest voter turnout rates. My next guest would like to change that. Rick Mercer, of course, is the host of The Rick Mercer Report. It opens its 13th season tomorrow night on CBC Television. He's with me in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
This has been a long campaign.
A cruel and unusual campaign, I think. And it's been frustrating for me because, of course, I've been just sitting at home watching it as a spectator, which is what most people do, but I like to be out mixing it up, and I would like to be on television during a campaign.
As a spectator, have you enjoyed this long campaign?
I've enjoyed the multiple debates. I thought that was a good development, the multiple debates. Mm-hmm. I was very disappointed that the consortium debate didn't happen.
Yes.
I think the debates were great, but, you know, I'm talking to my mother, and she's like, oh, they don't air in Newfoundland. I'm like, yes, Mom, it's on. No, we don't get it. It's on CPAC. What's CPAC? It's near the Fireplace Channel. Like, oh, they don't have it in Ottawa either. I called Joan. She said, like, people couldn't find it. And That's really unfortunate because some of those debates were great.
What do we learn from the debates, do you think?
Well, I thought the Monk debate was good. They didn't have notes. And I thought that was interesting because I thought when I heard no notes, I thought Trudeau's going to be in trouble because he was always wedded to that piece of paper in the House of Commons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like an actor, when you take their script away sometimes and throw them out on stage, sometimes they rise to the occasion, and I think he did. I didn't expect that with no notes. I thought the notes was going to be a problem.
What did you wish you were on television for during this campaign? Because there have been a lot of things.
There's the silly stuff.
Yes.
You know, there's stuff where you go like, oh, we've seen that before. Well, we have never seen a candidate, you know, urinate in a woman's coffee mug. That has never happened before in the history of campaigns.
Perhaps we should be thankful for that.
And maybe that'll be the end of it. But so there's always that silly stuff. Certainly this is the Twitter campaign. It's like so many candidates going down because of ridiculous stuff they said on social media. That's relatively new. But I would just like to have been there for the duration of the campaign, not for the silly stuff, but for, you know, just for the regular campaign stuff. I find it amazing that people didn't go, you know, just completely crazy over the notion that the Prime Minister refused to take follow-up questions. I mean, I wish if I was running the world, the media wouldn't have shown up. Like, I can't believe that you could get away with running a campaign, no follow-up questions. Now, of course, he'll take 10 follow-up questions as long as it's about the niqab. Like, that's, now he'll talk about that till the cows come home. So I think that even though he's on side with a lot of Canadians very upset about this niqab business, but they should be very nervous about the fact that suddenly he's willing to talk about this when he won't talk about other issues of substance.
You will be ranting about the election this evening.
I will be ranting from now till election day, but there'll be two rants on television.
One of the things that you said, I don't want to give too much away, one of the things you say is that we control in many ways this campaign. They don't tell us what the campaign is going to be
about.
Well,
they want to tell us what the campaign is about.
But they have told us, haven't they?
Well, they started off like, it's going to be about the economy. And then that wasn't working. And then they were like, okay, it's going to be about security. That wasn't working. Now it's about the kneecap.
How did it become about two women who wanted to take the oath of citizenship with the
Because Facebook? They hired a guy... And we all heard about it. They said, in breaking news, the Prime Minister's hired a guy whose job it is to get everyone upset about Muslims. And then next thing you know, everyone was upset. Wow. He's earning his money.
What do you make of the tone of this campaign? There are a lot of people. It doesn't matter what political
I've
stripe
seen
there.
Nastier. Yeah. I actually have seen nastier. I think today we're going to see a bunch of new ads roll out today and over the next 2 weeks where the tone is going to get very nasty. But so far, it hasn't been that nasty. And I think a lot of them, they don't know where to train their guns. And it's everyone is freaking out. Like, I have my little sources. Mm. Any of my NDP sources, they're freaking. The liberals, they're freaking. The conservatives, they're freaking. No one knows what's going to happen. You know, speechwriters usually have to write two speeches for a leader. We win or we lose. They're going to have to write six or seven. Like, there's so many different scenarios.
There's a thing that's circulating on social media, and it says, it's attributed to you, if you are between the age of 18 and 25 and you want to scare the hell out of the people that run this country, this time around, do the unexpected. Take 20 minutes out of your day and do what young people all around the world are dying to do, vote. Will we see, do you think, given everything that's at stake right now and the tone of the campaign, an increase in voter turnout?
I would like to think so. It's going to happen. Whether it happens this election or the next election, one of these days, it's going to happen and it will change everything. It will change the country. If young people show up to vote, it will just change everything.
What is the motivator? What is the one thing that will get, not just young people, but you get people who say, I don't matter. My vote doesn't matter. I can't be bothered. What's the thing that'll
change? You know, most people, we've launched this campaign called VoteNation.ca. And if you go there, you can take your photo and you can imprint it with I will vote October 19th. A lot of people who say, oh, I don't vote because it doesn't matter, this, that, or the other thing. They actually don't know how to vote. They've never voted. They're intimidated by the process. Their parents never took them to vote.
It's not just apathy. It's actually the process.
They actually don't know. What? Am I going to go in there? Is there a judge? Like, there's no cameras in there. People actually don't know. I was never intimidated because my parents used to take me to vote. Yeah, you know, it's 20 minutes. You go to St. Francis of Assisi, you walk in, boom, boom, you're in and out. People actually don't know. So that's why voting is contagious. If you tell your friends you're going to vote, they're more likely to ask you about it, or it can come up in conversation and maybe some of this intimidation will go away.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of
The following are two comedy skits that are not really political ads. They may reflect some people's views, but for legal reasons, no one here will acknowledge ownership. So laugh away, if in a slightly uncomfortable, too close to the truth kind of way.
Honey, the car is making that noise again.
Well, we should just get you a new one.
You can't afford a car.
Yes, we can, if I sell my guitars.
Wow. Okay.
Everyone knows that promises made during an election campaign mean nothing. So you have until October 19th to really score some points. Maybe a convertible.
Are you all right?
I am. And I was thinking, we should have your mother come visit us more often.
Okay, now I'm worried. You haven't been this generous since 2011 when you promised to stop calling my brother a... Wait, is this an election promise thing again?
Could be.
You're not getting me on that this time. Oh, cutie. I love your little games. And I'm not having an affair with the kid's swim coach.
Wait, you're not what?
I promise.
The guy with the abs?
His name's Devin.
This message brought to you by Windsor Salt. Until October 19th, take anything you hear with a grain of salt.
The Conservative Party is taking a stand on the niqab.
I'm very concerned about the kneecap issue. Plus, it takes my mind off the hopelessness of my job search.
It takes my mind off a lot of things.
The kneecap lets me focus my anger.
I've never actually seen a kneecap in real life, no. But I'd rather talk about one of those than the 75-cent dollar.
Well, we had to cancel our Florida trip this year. The kneecap also takes my mind off our children's tuition, which we can't afford.
And quite frankly, our intimacy issues.
Oh, we've tried everything. Nothing works. Nothing. All the pills, all the creams.
Can we get back to talking about the kneecap? Because yes. It's a terrible thing.
The kneecap also takes my mind off the fact that our personal household debt is at a crisis point.
I have a secret video gambling addiction.
These people need to stop kneecapping.
I'm thankful that Stephen Harper has given us the kneecap thing to focus on.
He's so clever. Did he invent the word kneecap? Because it's perfect.
People say the kneecap is a distraction, as if a distraction is not the best thing ever. like from life.
The Conservative Party of Canada, like a vacation for your mind.